A few years too young to really get Bob Dylan's music when it first hit in the early 60s. But when Dylan's backup group, The Band, went out on their own a few years later, I played those records over and over and over again.
I pulled into Nazareth, was feeling about half past dead.
The Band's music sounded unlike anyone else's at the time, and their songs told stories. Complex and quirky and authentic and wise and grown up. I was smitten as a 15-year-old. And when the band performed for the last time in 1976, as chronicled in Martin Scorsese's film The Last Waltz, I had just graduated college and started life. It felt like synchronicity. Robbie Robertson was the band's lead guitarist and principal songwriter and most charismatic member. And Robertson is now revisiting that part of his life with an album, his first in more than a decade, called How to Become Clairvoyant.
Oh, how to become clairvoyant. That's what I gotta know. So just show me where to sign. Invite me where to go.
Robbie Robertson, welcome to Studio 360.
Well, thank you, Kurt. Good to be here.
So this new album has immediately, I see, gone to number one on Amazon downloads. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And critics that I've read are sort of giving it, it seems to me, the best reviews you've had maybe since the days of The Band. How does that feel?
Well, it all feels good because making this record was really a great experience and one of the most enjoyable musical experiences that I've ever had. So if it all feels like that, the way that the critics and reviews are looking at it, I'm just very appreciative of all of that.
Why was it such a gratifying experience? And I presume that means other record-making experiences weren't so gratifying.
No, I think that I don't know that I've ever had a non-gratifying experience in making a record, but there are levels of gratification, uh-huh. And this is way up in the top.
It's the first album you've made in 13 years. Were you waiting for inspiration to strike or to reach a certain age? What made you wait to do this?
I wasn't waiting for anything. I didn't know that I was going to make a record. I was doing other stuff, broadening my horizon, trying to learn more things and having a really good time. So it wasn't, I got off that treadmill a long time ago of, oh, it's time to make a record.
I got to make a record every few years.
Yeah, yeah, and you're right. The bottom line is it comes down to inspiration. And when you think, oh boy, I'm just feeling it. I'm really ready to do this. It just seems like that's a good way to do things like this. And especially, I mean, you know, when you're very young and everything, you can play the rat race and it's comfortable. At a certain point, I think it should be done when, you know, the stars are aligned.
And the stars felt aligned?
Oh, yeah. Very much so.
As a songwriter, when I first got to know your music, you were really this great historical fiction writer, I have thought since, right? Creating these characters and stories and places. This record is more nonfiction, kind of a memoir. It's obviously drawn from your life. Let's listen to another track.
We headed straight south in a sundown light on Highway 61 through the Delta night. We share the back roads with card sharks and grifters, tent show evangelists, and look the drifter. What is lost?
That is Robbie Robertson's When the Night Was Young off his new album, talking about this man from young man from the north coming down through the weird American South and all of its characters and people. So there's at least reference to characters, but it's your life. Did that give you any pause saying I'm actually going to talk about myself 30, 40 years after the fact?
Well, I don't know exactly how I got on this path, but being reflective with this much distance in what I'm reflecting on just felt very comfortable now. And you're right, in the past I was much more drawn to the mythical, fictional characters and the storytelling. And this is still storytelling, but I don't mind being in this movie.
And now you're kind of a mythical, quasi-fictional character, I guess.
I've graduated.
I want to play another track. This is called Fear of Falling and features your friend Eric Clapton.
Sometimes you have to cut the cards just to find out what you got. She has a certain kind of thing. It's called the mystery of desire. Keeps pulling on my heartstring. I'm like a
That was Fear of Falling from Robbie Robertson's new album, How to Become Clairvoyant, with my other favorite musician of my teenage years, Eric Clapton. That sounds so good, and I'm having the experience of now hearing it with headphones for the first time. It sounds even better than it did to me off my computer. Hearing that, are you not, as I am wishfully inclined, to go out on the road with Clapton and sing some songs?
Well, it does sound like we're having a good time. I don't really do that anymore.
I know.
But, it's just I've learned that you should never rule out anything. We'll see what happens.
Uh-huh.
We have nothing planned, but there is...
Could happen?
It's, and anything's possible.
The record started out as a collaboration with him, did it not?
It started out us not really knowing what we were going to do, but that we've been talking for a long time about us doing something together, and it felt so comfortable and enjoyable that we would get together and talk about ideas and share stories with one another, and sometimes those things would start. And then we'd pick up a couple of guitars, and what we were just talking about would start creeping into the songs a little bit. And that was part of the personal connection as well. But I like the idea that we didn't have anything definite or definitive in front of us, that we could really just follow the music. And if something said, we really got to, do something. And that's what happened.
So it isn't as though you'd made a deal and said, okay, we're going to do this. Now we got to write the music. You just let it happen until it had ripened?
We didn't keep working on things. We had messed around with some ideas. And then a couple of years ago, Eric invited me to come to London and said, let's go in the studio and see what happens. And I went over and just him and I and a bass player and a drummer, the great Pino Palladino and Ian Thomas. And it started to really feel good. It was like we'd been playing together for years. And then on some things I said, we should have a keyboard player on a couple of these tracks. And he said, well, let's see if Winwood's in town.
That would be Steve Winwood.
Right. And so he called him up, and Steve did happen to be there. And so he came in, and it really felt like something that was meant to be. And it was almost surprising that we hadn't already done this.
And again, I'm not insisting that you go out and perform live, but did it feel so good being in a band with a bunch of guys your age that you wanted to keep doing that in some form?
I really like making records, and I know that I don't do it a lot, but when I do it, it's just an extraordinary experience to me, and I really go inside that world. And so what we were doing and what I was imagining that was going to, where this record was going to go musically, I got to a place where I was able to really make those things happen. They weren't just dreams anymore or things in my imagination. And with Eric and Steve and the other people that I've worked with on this record, and for me, it had nothing to do with them being, you know, legendary.
Eric Clapton, Steve Winwood.
Yeah. I mean, that wasn't the point at all. I don't need to do that. They don't need to do that. It was really about brilliant casting for the music, you know. And the way that Steve plays on these songs, you couldn't get it any better than that. It was just such a beautiful fit. And with the other people that I worked with on this record, too, it was like I was casting a movie. You know, I was saying, you know who would be just great to counterpoint what I'm doing here with what they do? And I kept reaching for things that I thought was the fulfillment of what was in my imagination.
And somebody that of a different generation, like Trent Reznor, who you got on this record, did that provide a sense of new blood from a different category of musician?
Didn't think about it like that.
Yeah, but you're casting.
Yeah. And it was like, who would be great to play this part on this song? And I don't think there was a better choice that I could have made. You know, he did something just what I was hoping it would be. And he did it in a way that allowed me to, he gave me the options to sculpt what he was giving me, so it completely fit the song and it just wrapped around things the way that I hoped it would. So
it almost sounds like you're directing a film in which you also happen to be starring.
And I do look at it that way to quite a degree. I mean, now that you put it like that.
The band dissolved more than half your lifetime ago. When you listen to that music today, which I did again in preparation for your coming, the night they drove Old Dixie Down and The Weight and Up on Cripple Creek and Life is a Carnival and all those, how does it strike you as, it's pretty good? Or is it about the memories of making the music? What do you think when you hear those songs, if you hear those songs?
Well, just because of the songwriting part of it for me, that I was really trying to do something special with the guys in the group. Same thing as what we were just talking about. I thought, wow, Richard could sing this character really good. And then if Levon comes in on the chorus in this part and he takes over the melody and then Rick goes up and sings the higher part, you know what I mean? It was like it was having an extraordinary workshop of characters. And so when I listen to that music now, first I think I immediately go to that place like, did I do a good job writing that song? That's the first thing, you know, that I'm just trying
And what's your answer to yourself?
I'm trying to make sure that the work is holding up for me. And I've done pretty good.
I mean, it was interesting. Not only did I love it at the time, but it doesn't seem in any way dated as so much music from the late 1960s and early 70s can, you know?
I was very much connected to other people making music that it seemed like there was just no expiration date on what they were doing. And whether you're listening to Duke Ellington or listening to Hank Williams or whatever it might be, that's what I was drawn to, and that's what I knew.
Uh-huh.
So it was just a natural thing to not be trendy,
right?
Or, you know, get caught up in what's happening now, man.
I hear you. When you hear those songs, is there one that you still have a special fondness for, or are they all children and you won't decide among them which one you like better?
Yeah, I think I like albums. This record that I've just made is, to me, a musical journey. You put it on at the beginning, and it's a ride until the end. It isn't about, oh, here's a couple of good ones. The rest of the stuff doesn't really seem to matter.
Yeah, yeah.
It is really the journey. And I think about those records in the same way. They're like chapters in a book. You know, I don't often think, now that chapter I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
I think I either liked the book or I didn't.
Yeah.
So I'm not inclined to reach and pick out things, but I do like Rag Mama Rag.
What is it about Rag Mama Rag that makes it your favorite among the band songs?
That's a piece of music that I've never heard anybody else in the whole wide world do. You know, it was really a combination of things that was happening in this band that when we were making that record, that to say, well, Rick, why don't you play fiddle on this one? And Garth, instead of playing the organ or keyboard, why don't you play piano? It's called Rag Mama Rag, okay? Let's do that. And Levon, maybe mandolin would be good on this. Richard, how about you play drums on this thing? And let me write a song that has a sense of humor to it and that nobody is doing anything like this. And just because it was such a departure and such an unusual thing, and I could honestly say that there was no other group that in the world that could have done that.
Well said. And one thing you said I think is important to remember about that era. There was so little humor in the rock music of the era. It was so self-serious. And here was a funny song that sounded like it was some plucked from some universe in the past that we weren't aware of.
Yeah, I think that the humor side comes from a lot of the characters that I had in the back of my mind, too. And in other songs, there's a sense of humor in The Wait. There's a sense of humor in Up on Cripple Creek, you know, and on and on.
Yep.
I mean, not all of the songs
right.
were like that at all. But I just thought it was part of the balance. That's what's real.
Well, it's interesting about albums, isn't it? When I was young, when you were making albums as part of the band, it seemed like, oh, pop music had evolved to this ambitious level where people had album ideas. Now, of course, in the last decades, we've seen that was a phase. I mean, there are now singles, essentially, and the album is the exception rather than the rule. Does that strike you as unfortunate?
Well, you take what you can get, and I know that some people are deliberately making albums, and I still really enjoy that. And whether it's Arcade Fire or The National or...
And non-Canadians.
Yeah. You know, that they're... I'm just more drawn to that.
Uh-huh.
And... most records that I hear nowadays, there is one or two tracks that I really like, and the others I can take it or leave it. Mm-hmm. And because nobody is raising that bar and saying, have you heard Marvin Gaye's record, What's Going On, or Van Morrison's record, Astral Weeks? You know what I mean? That where these things are just such a wonderful musical journey.
That's interesting. So you're saying the expectation is almost that there'll only be one or two good songs on an album and the rest is filler.
I don't think that people purposely think that in a lot of cases. And I think that there are people that do feel that that's today's format.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a waste of electricity.
Not vinyl anymore, but something digital and mental energy in a way.
You have to plug it in.
That's true. You had this successful career as a teenager from 16 to 22 as a sideman, and then essentially your big break came by working with Bob Dylan. He was only a couple of years older than you, and then you were his band as he freaked out his folky bass when he went electric. You were the electric,
right?
In that, speaking of electricity, what was that experience like? When this is Bob Dylan, and everybody suddenly hates him.
Well, there was first of all, we didn't know very much about folk music and Bob Dylan then. And the idea when people said, you're going electric, we'd always been electric.
Right, right.
There was no going for us, right? So all of this thing was a bit foreign, and we thought, well, we're just passing through town here. Don't really know if all of this stuff really has anything to do with where we're going musically.
Uh-huh.
And then when we got on that train, just to think, you know, because I really liked Bob at that time. You know, he was an interesting character and was doing really cool things, and we were having a wonderful time together. And when you're in the trenches, it was like being with a war buddy, almost, because of what we went through. And there was something, we toured all over North America, Australia, all over Europe, and every night we went out there, people booed us and threw stuff at us. And for us to say, oh, we're just building character here, might have been an illusion, but it did build character, and we didn't quite know, but it was a musical revolution that was going to change the course of music forever. And at some stage in there, because when you go out every night and that happens, and then we would listen to tapes of what we were doing, because I was very interested in getting better and us getting better at doing this, because in the beginning, I didn't think we were very good. And I thought, people are, you know, maybe they're right, you know. And everybody was telling Bob, you got to get rid of these guys.
Really?
Yeah. They're ruining everything for you. It's their fault. But when we would listen to these tapes and we could hear that we were really getting better and the connection and the music was becoming very solid, and we would listen to it, and we had time to listen to these tapes because nobody wanted to hang out with people that were being booed every night.
Right.
So, and finally I got to a place where we're right and they're wrong.
Uh-huh.
And that was a tricky thing, to go all around the world and come out of that saying, we're right and they're wrong. And it was, then we did a tour a few years later with the band and Bob Dylan, and nobody booed.
The world had caught up with you.
The world revolved and changed, and we did the same thing as we did before, but even a little bit better that time. And it was an interesting experiment in human terror to say, wow, we stood our ground, and the world came around.
Yeah. It's interesting that you say it was a character-building experience, because it could have been a soul-crushing experience. And since you were 25, 26 by the time the band emerged, not a 20-year-old or a 21-year-old, do you feel as though you had a kind of tempering and seasoning that allowed you to write better music and be a better band as a result?
Well, I wasn't that old. I think I was when we made music from Big Pink. I think I was at like maybe 24 then. But we had been together for 7 or 8 years.
Right.
Honing our skills, woodshedding, learning, gathering, doing probably what you should do.
Right.
To do something, to try to do something special.
Right.
If you've got the talent. And it felt... It just felt like that was our process. That was our schooling. This is what we've learned. This is what we've gathered. Here it is on a record. So when we made our first record, Music from Big Pink, I had no idea, because we were going completely against the grain.
Uh-huh.
This is not, was not...
It wasn't psychedelic.
It wasn't psychedelic, and it wasn't trendy. And it wasn't like what was happening
right.
at the time.
Right.
And
this is 1968. What are these woodsy guys doing?
Yeah. And it had the effect that you would hope it would have. It changed the course of music again. And people were all drawn in that direction as opposed to coming to us saying, listen, guys, you're going to have to turn. You're going to have to get louder. And
have 14-minute guitar solos.
Right. And do a lot more jamming.
You've been quoted as saying that in some sense in the late 60s, you and the band were rebelling against the rebellion. Do you mean musically or do you mean kind of generally?
Generally. We were not very good at following trends. And... when things became overly popular, we became quite suspicious of that. And because we'd been together long enough that we knew one another and nobody was saying, oh, we should be wearing polka dot suits or, you know, our album's called Big Pink. We should all be dressing pink clothes.
Mm-hmm.
It just was not who we were at all. And there was no front on this.
Right.
We didn't dress that way because that was a way to dress. That's just the way everybody dressed. And nobody thought about it or talked about it. It just was. And the music was the same way.
So you were indie before that phrase existed.
Maybe so, yeah.
You went from rock and roll to film scoring to being an entertainment executive to working with Neil Diamond, of all people. Has the course of your career been about trying to do things you're not sure you can do, but maybe you can, and that might be interesting? Is that the strategy?
I think challenge is great. I think when you put yourself up against it, and say, I don't know if I can do this, but I'm going to learn something from this, and I'm going to accept this challenge, and I'm going to do my best to just see what I'm made of in this context. I like that, and I grow from that.
Mm-hmm.
And the experiences that I've had and the directions I've chosen to go in, I wouldn't trade for anything. It really makes my blood flow, you know, to be able to put yourself on the line and say, can I produce a Neil Diamond record? Now, everybody said at that time, you can't do that. You shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
That's not right. And the more they told me that, the more I became convinced that this was something that I had to do. And I ended up having a great time doing it, did some special music with Neil, and I helped just get him inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, too, a few weeks ago. So it all comes round.
From Last Waltz on, you have been a pal and then collaborator of Martin Scorsese's. You've overseen the music, scored lots of his films, including Shutter Island, which I want to talk a little more about last year. Has that collaboration influenced your work, the work you're doing now, do you think, by yourself?
You know, you can't help but things to blend into, you're working on something. When I was making this record and I had gone to London and recorded, we recorded all the tracks for this record. And then when I got back, I immediately had to go into working on Shutter Island because I had, Martin Scorsese had said to me, this is very tricky musically, and I'm not sure what we should do in this case. And I suggested that we use all modern classical music that I thought, and I'd only read the script, and I said, I think there's a good chance that there could we could get an original feeling out of this. And he said, show me what you mean. And so I sent him some music, and he laughed and said, oh, yeah, I think this is going to work. And so then I had to really dig into that world. Like, I know something about modern classical music, but I'm not an authority. But by the time I was done with that movie, I was. And it was a great experience. And so after, then I went back to making this record. And because I was able to breathe and take a break from it, I had a clarity of all of the people that I wanted to work with, how I wanted to finish the songs, the lyrics, the directions, all of that. It all came together. And I found that to be an extraordinary luxury. And in some cases, in the songs on the record, I found myself scoring them more than just accompanying them with jangly guitars or something.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say all that because I thought, having read and seen Shutter Island, seen the John Adams music in it, mm-hmm. Morton Feldman, people like that, then I listened to this record. I'm going to play the openings of two of the songs off this record, and I guess maybe I was hearing influence that was actually there. First, Straight Down the Line. And then Madam X. So, Robbie Robertson, modern classical composer.
Well, that's Morton Feldman right there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You can't help but these things, you know, bleed into one another. And I think that that's so healthy. Just like collaborations in music, one and one makes three to me in these collaborations. And from the very beginning, if people were not mixing Delta blues and mountain music together, we would have never had rock and roll.
Yeah. Or country, if not for those mixes and so forth. Yeah.
Exactly.
No, and it struck me that after 20 years, I suppose, of people seeing ads with Philip Glass music and movie soundtracks with that kind of music, they're able to accept that mingling in a way they wouldn't have been a generation ago.
Perhaps. You know, one of the things in Shutter Island that I really wanted to get into the movie and into the soundtrack was in 1970, I heard a piece of music called Threnody for the Victims of Hiroshima by Krzysztof Penderecki. And it was so moving and powerful to me that I wrote to him and told him so. And then he wrote me back saying, oh, I'm really, you know, delighted that you're connecting with this. And then I sent him some music that I was working on then with the band. And he sent me some stuff, and we were like kind of pen pals there for a while. And since then, I've been thinking, that music needs to be in a movie. And I finally, it took a little while, but I finally achieved it.
So that wasn't just an overnight idea. This has had a long simmering boil, this idea.
Yeah, yeah.
Your mother is Native American. Your father is Jewish. How did they meet?
They met, my mother was born and raised in the Six Nation Indian Reserve. And her mother passed away when she was 15 years old. And she was sent to live with her aunt in Toronto. And she was living and going to school and working in Toronto and in the neighborhood that they lived in. And a place that she was working part-time, she met my father.
Did you, growing up in the 50s in Canada, did you feel like a double exotic, Indian and Jewish? Was that something you were made aware of in any kind of I'm an other kind of person?
Well, back then, it was called It's Better Not to Bring It Up, because it was like a combination that nobody could relate to.
Yes.
You know, Indians couldn't relate to it. Jews couldn't relate to it. Anybody else, forget about it.
And Canadians are too polite to ask.
Right. So, yeah, it just, you know, but when I was first playing music, people weren't talking very much about their heritage.
Right.
You know, whether somebody was Irish in their background,
right,
or Italian or whatever, it didn't seem to be like a lot of people were saying, well, you're going to have to fess up here and talk about this. It wasn't until later on, later in years, that it became
a thing.
That it became, people would say, isn't that interesting?
Right.
Because when you're inside that skin, you can't see that.
Sure.
And I was like, yeah, yes, yeah.
was there a moment as a kid? Was there a moment as a kid in Toronto where you discovered music and decided this is my life?
My musical connection came from the Six Nation Indian Reserve.
Really?
Because when we would go there, everybody, it seemed to me at that time, played an instrument or sang or danced. And I thought, well, I need to be in the club too.
Uh-huh.
That's what you do. There wasn't a lot of like big entertainment shows coming through the res that they had to make up their own entertainment. And so that was the beginning of the connection to me. And pretty soon relatives of mine started showing me, put your finger here and the thing there and then try this. And my hands were a little bit too small for it back then, but I was really interested. And so I kept following that, seeing if I could do it. And one day I realized I'm doing it, and I'm doing it better than they are. And so that was part of it. And the other part was the elders telling stories. And I also said, I want to be able to do that too.
Huh.
I want to be able to tell a story, and everybody just listens, and they're getting chill bumps listening to these stories and everything. So that was a very powerful, you know, connection and launching pad for me.
Good training. Both the storytelling, songwriting training and the musical training, right?
Yep.
And then was there a moment when you started hearing R&B or whatever it was that connected you to what was playing on the radio?
Well, what precisely happened was that by the time I reached puberty, I was playing guitar then. I had a guitar. I was standing at the crossroads. And
so to speak.
And yeah. And I've got a guitar in my hand. I've just become very interested in girls. And all of a sudden, out of the radio comes this sound called rock and roll. It was like a setup.
Yeah. No, it sounds like an unbelievable scene in your biopic.
Yeah.
What is it? Did you consider yourself Canadian at this point or not?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I just came from Canada, actually, and I love Canada. I love lots of things about it, and that's my roots. And, and I think Montreal's an extraordinary departure in North America. I think that Toronto is where I'm from is great, and going to Six Nations is fantastic for me. Going to Vancouver or any of it, there's so many elements of it that I feel a really strong attachment to, and they treat me very well up there.
Really? So you still show up at the reservation and they say, hi, Robbie, how's it going?
They have like little celebrations and welcoming things, and yeah.
How great.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I was thinking as I was about your generation of popular music legends, the Canadians among you, Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, Leonard Cohen in a different way, a little older, there's some kind of enduring soulful classiness about you Canadians. What is that about?
Well, I don't. You know, someone else will have to describe that. I just saw Neil in Toronto because we were up there for the Juno Awards, and he was receiving a humanitarian award because he does wonderful things, and he also won a Juno as well. And the Juno Awards were like really good this year, and so we got to do that and say hello. And then they were giving me the songwriter, inducting me into the Songwriter Hall of Fame there. And Daniel Lanois did an extraordinary musical tribute.
The producer.
Yeah. I mean, it was just haunting and beautiful what he did, and I was thrilled about that. And, you know, and other Canadians, too, did musical tributes. And part of the show was in French, and part of it was English, and just sitting there, I thought, this is just completely good stuff, you know, so.
Having had such fun doing this record, producing a thing that you're happy with, that the world seems happy with, did it make you, has it made you inclined to think, maybe I won't wait 13 years?
It definitely has. A couple of things have been spurred on by this record. Because of the personal aspect of it, I've just made a deal that I'm going to write an autobiography now. And I don't know if I would have gone there without the experience of this record.
This was the gateway drug to that?
Sorry. You know, you could call it that. So anyway, I'm going to do that. And I've already got some ideas for a new record that are stirring around in my head, and I've got some music things that I've begun. So I think I'll be a little quicker on the draw this time.
We have, before we go, we have a few questions from listeners that they sent in that they have for you. A listener named Donna Raskin says, I'm a big fan of both the band and Robertson's solo work, and I'm always struck by how different the two sounds actually are. I'm wondering if he feels like one is more him or if they are both him and one just required a band to come out.
Well, once again, because of the songwriting, you know, I feel just as strong a connection to both things. But in my solo work, I don't have to take into consideration like this record here, because it is much more personal, I wouldn't have felt comfortable telling the other guys in the band, well, I just wrote a song about myself here.
Yes.
I'm sure you'll be fascinated singing about me, you know. You know, and there's always personal things that seep into these things, but you could do it in, you know, in a different guise. And I was more comfortable with that. And in my solo stuff, because of the native North American element of what I've experimented with and my records, I can lean more. I don't have to take those other things into consideration.
Right.
But they're both just as, I feel, just as strongly a part of both things.
Which segues to another question from someone called Anderson East. Did Robbie really write practically every band song all by himself?
I wrote all of the songs I wrote some songs with Richard Manuel in the beginning, and then after a period of time, Richard wasn't feeling like writing anymore, so it kind of fell on my lap. But that was my job in the group, is to write the songs, and the other guy's job, and my job too, to have a vision of what we were doing. Somebody had to think of something, and excuse me. So I was really lucky to have amazing, I mean, like Garth Hudson, is such a unique musician. I mean, they broke the mold on that one. He's just completely unique. Levon, completely unique. And his playing and his singing, you couldn't do any better than that. And Richard Manuel, nobody's ever, brought tears to my eyes when they would sing a song like Richard could. And and Rick's bass playing completely unique, and Rick, his interpretation of my songs were, it couldn't get any better. So it was, like I said before, it was like having this extraordinary workshop of players that could do these things. But it was, you know, rather than me singing the songs, that would unbalance things. And so that I could write and kind of have a direction in it and would say that this was good casting again,
right.
You know, for what the different guys did. That was our makeup. That's how it worked.
What if the surviving members of the band called you up and said, "Yeah, bygones be bygones. Let's get together and put on a show." Would that interest you?
Well, I don't know if putting on shows interests me at all with anybody,
mm-hmm.
but I, you know, Garth, like I just said, is so extraordinary, and Levon's so extraordinary. I would never say never to working with these guys. They're my brothers. I love these guys, and there is no, from my end, there's no bygones or anything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What we went through together, you know, there's no way to replace that.
Robbie Robertson, thank you very much.
This was fun. Thank you.
Robbie Robertson's new solo album is called How to Become Clairvoyant.